Vaikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vaikatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really diving deep into an idea that, well, gets people talking. Universal Basic Income, UBI.
It definitely divides opinion. Economists, politicians, regular folks. But we're not just looking at the headlines today.
No, exactly. We're digging into the work of Carl Weiderquist. He presents a really thorough case for UBI.
And his argument is quite radical, really. He says UBI isn't just, you know, a policy tweak or some kind of handout.
Right.
He frames it as fundamental, a matter of social justice, even a necessary update to the whole social contract.
So that's our mission here, to get past the noise. You know, is it a crazy utopia or economic disaster? And actually understand Weiderquist's argument layer by layer.
Both the how it works and the why it matters, philosophically.
And the why now is pretty compelling, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look around. Automation, AI taking off, wealth getting more concentrated, the whole gig economy thing.
Yeah, lots of economic anxiety.
Precisely. So Weiderquist forces us to ask, with all this progress, all this wealth being generated, how do we make sure everyone actually benefits, not just a select few?
It's a critical question. Okay, so let's talk about Weiderquist himself. He's kind of an unusual figure in this space.
He really is, because he's not just coming at it from one angle. He's both a political philosopher and an economist.
Got the PhDs to prove it, too. Political theory from Oxford, economics from CUNY. Teaches at Georgetown in Qatar.
That dual background is key. It lets him build a case for UBI that's, well, strong on the moral side, but also grounded in, economic thinking. Pragmatic.
And he's not new to this. He was actually one of the co-founders of BEIN, the Basic Income Earth Network.
Yeah, he's been working on this for a long time. And central to his thinking is this philosophy he calls independentarianism.
Okay, let's unpack that. Independentarianism.
Right. This is super important because it totally reframes UBI. For him, it's not about charity. It's not the government deciding to be nice and redistribute some tax money.
So what is it then?
It's a matter of right, a fundamental right.
Okay. A right to what exactly? How does he justify that?
He argues it's a dividend. Think of it like this. We're all born into a world that has this vast inherited wealth, technology, knowledge, infrastructure, natural resources. Stuff none of us individually created.
Our collective inheritance, sort of.
Exactly. And because it's collective, we all have a rightful claim to a share. UBI, in this view, is simply your share, your dividend from that commonwealth. It's owed to you.
Huh. That really does change the perspective. It's not, can we afford to give this,
yes.
But what share is rightfully everyone's.
Precisely. It shifts the whole burden of justification. Okay, so the book itself, it's in the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series, so it's meant to be accessible, but also, comprehensive.
Right, a solid primer, trying to get beyond the shouting matches.
Yeah. And the core argument is pretty bold. That UBI is a practical way to achieve genuine freedom and security for everyone. It makes us question that old assumption that your basic survival has to be tied to having a wage-paying job.
So how does he build that case in the book? What's the journey?
It's quite systematic. First, he looks at our current welfare systems. Points out the flaws, the complexity, the way they often trap people in poverty rather than helping them escape.
The bureaucracy, the conditions.
All of that. Then, after showing what's wrong, he lays down that philosophical foundation we just talked about, justice, real freedom.
And then he tackles the big objection.
Exactly. He confronts the two major practical worries head on. Will people stop working? And can we actually afford this?
Got it. And he brings in history, too, like Paine and Martin Luther King Jr.
Yep. Shows it's not a totally new idea. And critically, he backs it all up with evidence from actual UBI pilot programs around the world.
Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty then, the definition. You hear UBI thrown around, but Weiderquist is very specific. What makes something true UBI?
Right, the details matter. He outlines five core characteristics. Mm-hmm. It has to be. One, periodic paid regularly. Two, cash people decide how to spend it. No vouchers.
Okay, those seem straightforward.
They are. The next three are where the real differences lie. Three, it must be individual, paid to each person, not the household.
Why is that individual part so important?
It's about autonomy within the family.
Mm-hmm.
It means, say, a woman isn't dependent on her husband's payment, or an elderly parent isn't reliant on their kids. It prevents control and potential abuse within the household. Gives everyone a bit of independence.
Makes sense. Okay, number four.
Universal, paid to everyone, rich or poor, employed or not. no means testing.
And 5.
Unconditional. This is maybe the most defining feature. No strings attached, no work requirements, no drug tests, no making people jump through hoops.
And that's the big difference from most welfare today, right? The conditionality.
Absolutely. The moment you add conditions, you need administrators to check them, you create stigma, you get that welfare wall where people are afraid to earn more because they'll lose benefits. UBI avoids all that complexity. It's simple.
Okay, so that's the what. Now, back to the why, the philosophy bit. You mentioned real freedom. What does he mean by that? It's not just about laws, right?
No, not just legal rights on paper. Real freedom is having the actual practical ability to use those rights. I mean, think about it. If you're constantly worried about where your next meal is coming from, or if you can pay rent.
Yeah, your legal freedom of speech doesn't feel very useful.
Exactly. All your energy, your mental space, is just consumed by survival. Weidekvist argues that basic economic security is the necessary foundation for people to actually make meaningful choices, participate in society, exercise their freedoms.
So economic security enables real choice.
Yes. And that leads to this really powerful concept he talks about, the power to say no.
The power to say no to what?
To exploitation. If you have a basic income floor, you're not forced to take any job, no matter how dangerous, low-paying, or degrading, just to survive. You have the power to refuse.
Ah, so it shifts the power balance in the job market away from desperation.
Completely. It moves things towards genuine consent, not coercion masked as choice, because the alternative is destitution.
Okay, I can see the philosophical appeal, but let's switch gears to the practical stuff. Weidekvist claims UBI is actually economically efficient. How does that work? It sounds expensive.
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, right? But the efficiency comes from a couple of places. First, think about the massive bureaucracy needed to run current welfare programs.
All the paperwork, the caseworkers, checking eligibility.
Exactly. It's incredibly complex and costly to administer. UBI, because it's universal and unconditional, cuts way, way down on that administrative overhead. Much simpler.
Okay, simpler administration. What else?
The second big thing is avoiding that poverty trap or welfare wall we mentioned.
Where taking a job means you lose benefits, so you're hardly better off or sometimes even worse off.
Right. With UBI, because you keep the basic payment no matter what, every single dollar you earn from working actually adds to your total income. Work always pays more.
So it removes that disincentive to take on part-time or low-wage work as a starting point.
Precisely. It encourages work, education, maybe even starting a small business because you have that basic security floor.
Okay, I get the efficiency argument in theory, but politically, getting rid of existing systems and redirecting funds, that sounds like a monumental task. Does he address how you'd actually do that?
He acknowledges the political challenges, definitely. But his focus is more on presenting the long-term benefits as outweighing the transitional difficulties. He sees it as an investment.
An investment in people.
Yeah, an investment in human potential, health, stability. He argues the evidence shows these benefits are real and substantial, justifying the political effort needed for the change.
All right, let's tackle the big two objections directly. First, the work disincentive. The classic, won't everyone just stop working, argument.
Right. Weidekvist hits this hard. First, he points out the UBI level being discussed is usually for basic subsistence, not, you know, a life of luxury. Most people want more than just subsistence. They want better lives, nicer things, purpose.
So the desire to improve your situation doesn't just vanish.
Exactly. But more importantly, he dives into the actual data from real-world experiments.
And what does that data show? Do people quit their jobs en masse?
Overwhelmingly, no. Studies like Mincom in Canada back in the 70s or the more recent Finnish experiment, they consistently find only small reductions in paid work hours.
Small reductions? Where do they happen?
Well, they tended to be concentrated among specific groups, primarily students who use the security to stay in school or get more education.
Which is arguably a good thing long term.
Right. And the other group was secondary earners, often mothers with young children, who reduced paid work hours to spend more time on unpaid caregiving. Again, you could argue that's a socially valuable outcome, not a disaster.
So no collapse of the workforce, more like a reallocation of time towards education and care. Hmm. Interesting. Okay, objection number 2, affordability, the sticker shock. Critics point to the huge gross cost.
Yeah, the numbers look staggering if you just multiply a basic income amount by the entire population. But Weidekvist argues That's the wrong way to look at it. You need to look at the net cost.
Net cost, meaning after accounting for savings and new revenue.
Exactly. The net cost is much lower because, one, you'd replace a lot of existing inefficient welfare spending you consolidate. And two, you fund it through progressive tax reforms, maybe taxes on resources or carbon emissions.
So it's about restructuring how money flows, not just adding a massive new expense line.
Pretty much. It's about circulating wealth differently. He emphasizes that societies are incredibly wealthy. The issue is distribution, not absolute scarcity.
He also looks at real-world examples, right? Like the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend.
Yes, the Alaska PFD is a fascinating case. It's not a full UBI, but it's universal and funded by oil revenues.
And it's been around for decades.
And it's incredibly popular. Politicians have tried to cut it, but because everyone gets it, there's huge public support. It demonstrates that universality can create political resilience. People see it as the rightful share, not a handout.
What about more recent trials like Stockton in California?
Yeah, the Stockton Seed Project gave people $500 a month, no strings attached. And what they found directly countered the myth that people would waste it.
What do they spend it on?
Overwhelmingly basic needs. Food, utilities, rent, paying down debt, things that reduce stress and increase stability.
And in developing countries, like give directly in Kenya.
There, the evidence shows unconditional cash often leads to investment. People buy livestock, improve their farms, start small businesses. It acts as seed capital, basically, a development tool.
Okay, so pulling all these threads together, what are the really core themes or messages that emerge from Weiderquist's analysis?
I think the first big one is framing UBI as a property right.
Right.
Seeing it as that dividend from our shared inheritance, not as welfare. That fundamentally changes the conversation.
It's not something you earn through labor. It's something you're owed as a co-owner of societal wealth.
Exactly. The second theme is dignity and unconditional support. By removing conditions and means testing, you eliminate the stigma, the shame, the bureaucratic hoops associated with traditional welfare. It treats everyone as a citizen with rights.
Fosters trust instead of suspicion.
Right. And the third theme, which is really forward-looking, is UBI as vital infrastructure for managing technological change.
Preparing for automation and AI.
Yes. As technology potentially decouples economic production from human labor, UBI provides a way to ensure the immense productivity gains benefit everyone, not just the owners of the robots or algorithms. It helps share the prosperity.
And it also implicitly values unpaid work, right? Like caregiving.
Absolutely. Work that the market doesn't currently reward financially, but is essential for society. UBI provides a base for everyone, acknowledging those contributions too.
Weiderquist really does have a way of phrasing things that sticks with you. Any particular lines or ideas from the book that stand out?
Oh, definitely. That core idea about freedom. Real freedom requires not just the absence of barriers, but the presence of genuine opportunities to make meaningful choices.
That just nails the difference between having a right on paper and actually being able to exercise it. Poverty limits choice.
It really does. Another one is about the universality. UBI treats every citizen as equally deserving of basic security, eliminating the moral judgments that contaminate traditional welfare systems.
Yeah, that gets to the heart of the dignity argument. No judgment, just recognition of shared citizenship and need, universal solidarity.
Mm-hmm. And then looking forward, UBI provides essential infrastructure for managing technological change, ensuring that automation serves humanity rather than displacing it.
That frames it not as a cost center, but as a strategic investment in stability and shared progress during a potentially disruptive transition. Insurance for the future, almost.
Exactly. It's proactive, not just reactive.
So, bringing this home for someone listening, what are the real-life applications? How does this thinking connect to our everyday lives?
Well, first, there's personal financial security. Understanding Weiderquist's point about stress and cognitive bandwidth, it helps you appreciate how even a little bit of financial stability frees up mental energy.
Energy currently spent worrying about bills, maybe.
Right. Energy that could go towards planning, learning, making better long-term decisions instead of just putting out fires. Even having a small emergency fund does this. UBI aims to provide that baseline universally.
And the power to say no idea has direct relevance for workplace dynamics, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Even a modest basic income increases your bargaining power as a worker. You're less desperate, so you're better positioned to negotiate for fair wages, better conditions, or to leave a truly bad situation.
Or maybe take a risk, like starting your own thing.
Exactly. It could fuel entrepreneurship because the cost of failure isn't total destitution.
And then there's the bigger picture, civic engagement.
Yeah, the argument is that when people aren't trapped in survival mode, they have the security and the headspace to participate more fully in democracy, think about long-term community issues, and hold leaders accountable.
Less stress, more participation. It makes intuitive sense.
It suggests economic security underpins a healthy democracy.
So, reflecting on this deep dive into Weiderquist's work, what's the biggest takeaway for you? What was most surprising or impactful?
For me, it's really that paradigm shift he forces. Moving away from seeing UBI as just, you know, a cost or a drain on the economy.
And seeing it instead as?
As an enabler. As something that could actually unlock human potential, creativity, and innovation that's currently stifled by economic insecurity and precarity. It's investment, not just an expense.
Yeah, that reframing is powerful. For me, the crucial insight was how rigorously he builds the case. It's not just wishful thinking.
Definitely not utopian dreaming.
No. It's presented as a serious, evidence-informed proposal designed to tackle very real, very structural problems we face now and likely even more in the future. And that universality, it's not a bug. It's the central feature for building solidarity.
Absolutely. It makes it about us, not us versus them. A shared stake in our collective future.
A really thought-provoking exploration.
Indeed. Lots to chew on there.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.